Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. What if you had the chance to live your life again and again until you finally got it right? In British author Kate Atkins' newest novel, Life After Life, Ursula Todd is born and dies. Ursula Todd is born and lives. And as the book progresses, the plot lines interweave and fold back on themselves as Ursula lives and dies in her many timelines. Some of those timelines are quite short, others quite lengthy and detailed. And through it all is the hulking shadow of the Second World War and the London Blitz. Life After Life finds Atkinson exploring chance and fate and how the smallest action or inaction by one person can profoundly affect the course of history, both personal and collective. Atkinson was in Milwaukee in April on a book tour, and she stopped in to talk with us then. Kate Atkinson, welcome to Lake Effect. It is such a pleasure to meet you.
Oh, thank you.
Beginning again and again and again, I think it's something that many of us would like to be able to do, to correct something that we think, oh, if I'd only been able to do this or known something differently or chosen a different path. Ursula Todd gets to do this throughout the entire book, over and over.
But she's not aware she's doing it. And I think that's the difference. I've been thinking about this because if you get to choose, then you think, oh, I'll do this differently or I'll take a different path. But actually, all she knows is a kind of deja vu. She's not aware of those past lives. So she actually keeps making mistakes at the same time as she unconsciously corrects the others. So she doesn't have that much power. Someone else was saying that to me the other day. Oh, she gets to correct her mistakes. But actually, she's not even aware of it. So it's a different thing, isn't it? So she's not in the place where she can go and put, you know, £100 on the 310 at Cheltenham or the lottery or something. She's just kind of nosing her way through it in a way that I think is very uncomfortable for her. But she does rectify mistakes, but only out of kind of instinctive thing. Something sort of kicks in her brain and she's oh, no, I won't step out onto that roof, you know.
Do you think that that's something that we all have, that sort of instinctive, if we listen to that still voice in ourselves?
I don't think many of us listen to that still voice.
No, I don't think we do, but I wonder if...
I think maybe we've grown up, you know, I mean, we're still Stone Age people. Our bodies are still Stone Age. Our brains probably still are. And I'm sure that if we lived a much more natural life closer to nature, we would actually live on our instincts a lot more. But we're so used to, as a civilized, and I use rabbit ears when I say civilized society, that we've grown away from those things that we instinctively might think is, you know, it's not a good idea to go around there because there's the woolly mammoth that's about to pounce on me. Well, I don't know if woolly mammoths pounce, saber-toothed tigers maybe, but, you know, we've become so enmeshed in concrete and steel and a different kind of life that I don't think we do live by instincts.
One of the things I loved about reading this, the sense of her growing into herself.
Definitely. And I think those lives that she's living again and again, it's more like the image I would use is it's more like layers and layers and layers, so that her character remains the same. She is the same person. She's certainly the same person almost from when we first meet her as a baby, I think. But those layers of experience somehow make her stronger. Even when she's still prone to making mistakes and saying hello to that wrong person, she's still growing in a different way to the way that you and I would grow. You know, she's not on a journey. She's on some different kind of narrative.
The image that came to mind is like the fabric of her is getting more and more tightly woven each time I meet her in her next life.
Yes, that's a good image.
Life.
Yeah, and tougher. She gets tougher. All the time she gets tougher.
And funnier.
Yes, she is. She becomes drier and more likable, I think. Well, she's not unlikable to begin with, but I think she becomes more and more a fully rounded person until, you know, when we leave her at the end, we have a very full picture of what she's like, I think.
The other very central part to this book is the Second World War and events leading up to it. The war itself, the Blitz in London, plays a huge part. And those particular timelines where she's in London were for me, I mean, just heartrending. And so I felt I was there. And what is it about the Second World War for you that made putting her in that particular time and place?
I would like it to have been me, I think. I would really like to have lived through the war. I know some people think that sounds sick. But actually, I think it would have been an astonishing experience. And most people, you say that, you would go, oh my God, I wouldn't. The only other person who has instinctive, no, there's only a couple of people who've said, oh God, yes, I would have lived through the war. And one of them is my cousin, who's a soldier, and the other one is a woman who's written about the fiction about the Second World War. But I think to live your life at that heightened pitch must have been extraordinary. It is a unique event. Well, every event is unique. Every second is unique, I know. But that is something that will never occur again. We will never find ourselves under those conditions again. Even if we were to go to war and be bombarded, it certainly wouldn't be like that. And I think, you know, the Blitz lasted, oh, I don't know, 56, 57 days, 58 days, nonstop. It went on longer than that, but that was nonstop, nightly and sometimes daytime raids. And the effect that had on people, it made them, I think, more callous in many ways because they were seeing a lot of death, but it also made them more looser in all ways, you know, both morals and thinking and philosophy, because if you think that there's a chance that you might die tonight or tomorrow, then you do look at your life differently. So I think people probably viewed their own mortality in a very different way from the way that we do, because we live our lives as if we're going to live forever, whereas they were living their lives as if they might die tonight. And I think that's a interesting, fascinating thing. But also you do hear people say, particularly women, saying they had a good war and they enjoyed it, even though it's not the kind of thing that they should say. It's not very, you know, PC, but nonetheless, they enjoyed the freedom, I think.
For Ursula and for that time, you've said that this is sort of an exploration of what it meant to be British and what it meant to be English at that time. What do you think? What did you find out about being English at that time writing this book?
I don't know. You want to say it's about being English, but really maybe it's just about being in those circumstances. I think perhaps I stopped thinking of it being like that so much. But in a way, I mean, I wanted to recreate the Second World War for me, so that by fictionally recreating it, it's the only way I would get to live through that time, and in a much safer way, obviously. But I know it's difficult, because also then you start thinking, have I been infected by propaganda? But I think it showed up, you know, the stoicism of people, because when you read the actual, say, mass observation diaries, rather than looking towards propaganda, people are just getting on with things. They really are in a very rather downtrodden way. They're more interested in where they can get a torch battery from or a can of beans than they are really about their existence. But I don't know. I think there's a point in the book where Ursula says, you know, this is what I'm fighting for, and it is England. But what she's fighting for really is home and family. It's Fox Corner, where the family are. It's her brothers and sisters. It's what she's grown up with. That's England becomes a very small thing, rather than this big patriotic, you know, we must fight.
And everyone's probably fighting
for their own little corner, yes.
Right.
Yes, I guess.
One of my favorite characters, Miss
yes.
Wolfe.
Yes.
And she talks about the importance of bearing witness. And I think that resonates throughout the entire book, because Ursula is almost bearing witness to her entire life over and over.
I was very pleased when I wrote that, because I realized that was a point I'd been working to without knowing what the sentence was that I was going to put there, because, you know, the Blitz is the heart of the book, and the book's always, for me, it was going to be about the Blitz. But it was, I didn't know what it was I wanted to say until Miss Wolfe says it. And I think for me, in a way, I am bearing witness, because I now am bearing witness. As they said, in the future, people will bear witness to us. And I am that person. I mean, obviously, I'm not alone, but this is my way of bearing witness to them, I think. And so it goes on.
I was so viscerally in that place and that time. I could smell it. I didn't live through that. I'm not even English, you know. But there was something about the way Ursula lived through all of the various timelines, because she was in many different ones during the Blitz, that it just really struck. The other side of that, which I also found fascinating, is that you have her in timelines where she was not there at all, and she was in Germany.
I can't really pinpoint the moment at which I thought she has to go to Germany as well. But I think because there is a her half-sibling who was adopted and is taken away is brought up in Germany. In a way, it felt to me that there was a Todd, a member of the Todd family over there. And they do talk about him. And they say, funny to think that that baby is now the enemy. And there is an equality there. The Germans and the British, they're very alike. They're, you know, we're civilized. Well, again, I've got the rabbit ears here. But we're civilized European countries who have a long culture with, you know, and at the beginning of the war, many English people were very upset that we were at war with Germany because they had friends in Germany, they'd visited Germany, they'd holidayed in Germany. And so there's this sense that, you know, what is the difference given the right circumstances? I think, as Ursula says in the book, could have been us. You know, and that's something that's never popular when I say it. But, you know, there is a parallel there. And, of course, although we remember the Blitz, it's, you know, written into our history so very brightly, what we did to the Germans was infinitely worse. Germany was destroyed. There was fears that Germany would never, ever recover as a country, that it had gone because it was bombed so much. So it seemed only right, in a way, to go over to the other side and experience that for her.
Did you find, as you were working through these parallels and these, like, I'm trying to even find the right word. It's not repetition. It's the sort of the reversal and return and mm-hmm. starting out again. Mm-hmm. Were there some stories that simply just didn't work, that you had to abort and say,
No, somebody asked me this, I think, the other night. Did I get rid of a lot of things? Did I go back and, you know, things didn't work? And no, I just wrote it. It just was literally one sentence after the other. There was always just, it flowed as a book. It really did. I hardly rewrote it, to be honest.
I find that fascinating because it reads that way. It reads very seamless for something that isn't a linear narrative. Yeah.
No, there's a rhythm to it, though, because and that rhythm is the base. She lives, she dies, she lives, she does. So that I think that life, those lives flowed in a way that the writing followed them. I think it was one of the easiest books I've ever written. And I think it was because also I was very emotionally engaged with it, so that, you know, some books you're more emotionally engaged with than others. One hopes one's always engaged with the book that you're writing. You must always like the book you're writing. But I think with this one, I really felt it on the pulses somehow.
How about the ending? Was it difficult to figure out where to stop?
No, I always knew where I was going to stop.
Really?
I generally know where I'm going to start, where I'm going to stop. It's just the middle bit that's difficult to fill in.
Those other 500 pages.
Yes, and that thought develops very strongly as you're writing. More and more you realize that this is the place that you're going to. And it's lovely to have a goal. I would hate to be writing in a completely open-ended, because I write in an open-ended way, but I do know the end. And so there's always somewhere to go. So that's kind of comforting when you're stuck in the middle of those 500 pages.
Do the goalposts ever shift, though? You have an idea, but does it ever tell you, you know, wait, no, we're really going to go over here?
Not really. Sometimes I had a, shall I do this or shall I do that moment? This character Tracy, shall I let her get away with it or shall I not? And for a long time I thought I wouldn't let her get away with it. And then I just thought, no, that's so cruel. Let her get away with it. So it was a kind of, that's a big shift by the sound of what I'm saying, but not really, because that was always the place I was going, was Tracy and whether she got away with it or not. So no, it's curious, because you would think that you're going to write all those 500 pages, you would change your mind about where it is you're going. But on the whole, I always end up there. Which is a miracle, honestly.
Well, I've heard other writers say that sometimes the characters dictate to them where, you know, it's like you said about Miss Wolf, not knowing what you were thinking until she said it for you. And I was thinking, well, maybe sometimes Ursula or another character might say, you know, no, really, I want to go over here, you know, not there.
No, I think, you know, one does talk about characters as if they have lives of their own. But, you know, ultimately, I know that I'm in charge, and that because it would be kind of madness if they were in charge. But it's the way you develop them, I suppose, that takes you. And the new characters suddenly spring, because I love minor characters. So sometimes all those little minor characters that pop up, they're kind of, you know, they make you change slightly in direction. But on the whole, no, they don't. I don't know. I find character endlessly fascinating, because although again, it sounds like madness. All writers will say characters appear fully formed and they don't know how that happens. And I don't. They're suddenly there. I don't construct those characters. I don't sit down and put bits together like they're, you know, dolls I'm making. They just appear and that's them. And their character is quite fixed, really, for the rest of the book. It's only their experiences that develop them, not anything in their real true nature. So, and I know that sounds slightly at odds with the idea that they're dictating, but I just don't understand character, and I would really like, I don't know, some kind of maybe a writing coach or a writing neurologist or somebody who could really explain the processes of what it is, what is happening when you're writing, because it's an odd thing, because a lot of it's unconscious, I think.
And there are some amazing small characters that may only be in one chapter or may have a through line also that parallels or that pops in different ways. Do you have particular favorites in this book? I have a couple that...
Well, I do particularly like Miss Wolf. I think Miss Wolf, in a way, is the moral center of the book. And I like all of the dogs. But Teddy, Ursula's baby brother, is always real, the real true heart of the book, because I think it's her, it's for him that she, in a way, does everything, I think. And what happens to her, I think, is dictated by just that one love as well as the love of the whole world, I think. The two become meshed together, I think, for Ursula.
I also love her relationship with Pamela.
Pamela, yes.
I adore Pamela.
Yeah. She's very straightforward, jolly hockey sticks English girl.
And she says it so bluntly.
Yeah,
and so
I
but it's just, she's so refreshing. And I like her a great deal. And her insight and the foil that she provides for Ursula is just lovely in all of the different permutations that happen.
And they're always very close. They always, you know, they never fall out. They always love each other, which is nice. I have no siblings, so I have to invent all these siblings.
The siblings you wish you had.
The siblings,
yeah.
Well, only the good ones, not Morris,
no,
the elder
Morris.
Brother. Someone said to me at an event in Canada, were you aware that you were making Hitler seem more attractive than Morris?
I hadn't put it that way, but you did, actually. I also like Hugh very much.
Oh, I love Hugh, yes.
Yeah, that's her dad.
He's a wonderful English gentleman. He's very sound, very, very sound. No, it's yes. Yes, I do like Hugh. It's funny that you talk about your characters as if they're somehow people.
Well, in a way they are, and
no,
for the readers,
no,
too.
No, they're not.
But they're not.
I know, they become like people. I know, I'm aware. Sometimes I do have to be careful because someone will tell me how much they love a character. I'm like, really?
Is there anyone in here that anyone has told you that? And you've thought, really, you like that person?
Oh no, I can't remember. Somebody told me how much they disliked someone. And I was, no, someone told me, it was a Canadian journalist, I think, who told me how much they disliked Pamela. And I was like, why? And I thought, no, they must have completely misinterpreted her character because there's nothing unlikable about her, I don't think. But no, they totally dislike Pamela.
Interesting.
It's funny, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
It is how people react to that, as you say, as if they were actual people.
Yeah.
So now, what's next for you? Are you on another book?
Not really. I'm sort of thinking about another book. I've always planned to do a companion book to this, called A God in Ruins, which is a quotation from Emerson, Man is a God in Ruins, which I think is the most wonderful. I've really just been looking for a book to have that title, but it's Teddy's story, and more the grown-up Teddy, I think. So I haven't quite settled on how to make Teddy move from one book to the next, because he's always really, in a way, I know he grows up in life after life, but in a way he's always a little boy, so I have to find the grown-up Teddy's character.
And in a way he's almost a reflection
of himself. He's a cipher, yes, he is. So making Teddy come to life is a challenge, actually. That will be, in a way, a construction of character in some way. So it might not work, I don't know.
Well, we'll see.
We'll see.
We'll see. The book was one of those that I sat up until 1 a.m. to finish. Not because I was late. I actually finished it a week ago, but I couldn't put it down. Mm. And as things started to get more and more wrapped up and I started to see where you were going, it's like, I want to know what happens to this person. So thank you so much for writing something that made me want to do that.
No, thank
and
you. That's very kind.
It's such a pleasure to have you here, Kate Atkinson. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Kate Atkinson is the author of Life After Life, which is published by Little Brown and Company. Atkinson is a prize-winning author of 6 novels, including Behind the Scenes at the Museum, which won the Whitbread Award for Book of the Year. She lives in Edinburgh when she's not on tour, and she was in Milwaukee in April, and she spoke with us then. We'll take one last break and then return with the story of a Wisconsin star on the rise. Lake Effect will be right back with an in-studio performance by Trapper Shep and the Shades. You're listening to Milwaukee Public Radio.